This is Barbara Ridenour with the Decatur Herald and Review, dated March 3rd, 2017. As usual, we'll start on the front page with challenging positions in education. School board candidates address perceptions, priorities. Kathy Williams attended the school board candidates forum at the Decatur Civic Center on Thursday to get questions answered and to help her make up her mind among them. I wanted to meet them all because I didn't know them all, and I wanted to hear what they had to say, Williams said. I think it's good to go and to debates like this. I had my mind kind of made up before I came in here, but I changed it. I wrote down the questions and gave them stars by the ones I liked. She said she was impressed by B.A. Butz's 50 years in education. She liked Beth Creighton's parent perspective. She also noticed that write-in candidate Janice Gavin paused and considered before answering questions, calling that thoughtful. I think she's a thinker, Williams said. I heard some negative things I didn't like from the candidates. I heard some negative things I didn't like from the candidates at all, and I'm not sure if some of them have really moved on from last year's controversy over former Superintendent Lisa Taylor. You hear some of them say they have, but you won't know until they get there. That question did come up, asked by the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People's Mildred Bond. The NAACP and the Herald and Review jointly sponsored the forum. Bond asked all the questions to respond to the Four Yellow Chairs movement a year ago that called for all four board members who were perceived to be against Taylor's contract extension to be voted out. Creighton said those four got what they wanted, but that she is tired of talking about the issue and ready to move forward. Taylor has moved on, and I think it's time for us to do the same. Incumbent Alita Graham said that the whole issue was based on faulty assumptions about a confidential personnel matter, and that one of those was that the four board members in question did not want to extend Taylor's contract. The four board members who did not speak publicly were following the advice of the district's legal counsel, and that left the public to draw conclusions without all the information. I think we are in a position where we need to be moving forward, Beth Nolan said. I think it has come to light that while certain incumbents are touting the fact that they were responsible with confidential information but are now able to talk about that, while they're up for re-election is opportunistic, to say the least. Herald and Review editor Chris Coates asked the candidates about the most important priorities for the next superintendent, expected to be hired later this month. With at least two new board members and a new superintendent, said Al Scheider, he would suggest the board hold a retreat with that new superintendent to give everyone a chance to get to know each other and determine those priorities as a group. The candidates also discussed the value of a Decatur Public Schools diploma and how to better prepare graduates to enter college or careers. Butz said he believes that the district needs to know what students can and cannot do well and work with business leaders to determine curriculum that will best prepare students for the next step in life, which might not always be a university. He suggested that high school should have 2 years of general education followed by 2 years of either a career or college track, depending on the student's interest. And if work is their immediate goal, partnerships with businesses to provide apprenticeships and internships. Reestablishing trust with the community and open lines of communication are important, said Kendall Briscoe. We need to be transparent, she said. One thing is missing on the board is a parent perspective. The present board includes several parents, she said, whose children are grown, while she, Creighton, and Nolan have children in the schools now. Policy needs to answer the needs of the staff, Courtney Carson said. We must listen. A lot of times individuals just want to be heard. Reaching families who are in poverty with help locating job training that will lead to employment will improve life for those families, he added, and that will improve the children's attendance and academic achievement. One of the questions Bond asked the candidates was regarding the diversity in schools. She said two buildings in Decatur lack diversity, with a third trending in that direction, and asked them their opinions on the issue. All of them said diversity is one of the strengths of a public school system. Graham said a board policy was once in place, but is no longer, that required all the buildings to be within 10% to 15% of the racial proportions of the population. Decatur did not desegregate under a court order, but voluntarily, she said. And she'd like to see that board policy reinstated and boundaries studied to create better balance. Carson, with a chuckle, said his family is our own little rainbow push coalition. He is African American, his wife is white, and his children are mixed race. Nolan's answer was that racial balance is not the only consideration. She'd like for the district to consider income disparity as well, so that schools show more balance in all areas. One way to do that, she said, is to draw families who have left Decatur back to Decatur schools, as families have been drawn back to Dennis School in recent years. Retiree Mark Schleter moved to Decatur after retirement, and he said he doesn't have any children or grandchildren in Decatur schools or who are graduates, yet schools are important to him. Two things people look for when deciding to move to a community, he said, are jobs and good schools. I don't know a lot about the candidates, he said, because of the superintendent issue stuff swirling around. I was in an anti-incumbent mood as I came in, although one of the incumbents impressed me in terms of knowledge and how they articulated goals and all that. A number of new candidates also impressed me as well, as far as being knowledgeable and articulate about having a stake in it by the fact that they actually have kids in school. We obviously have 8 really strong candidates, said Robert Bryce, a Decatur resident. Today it's hard to get people to run for office for a variety of reasons. So I think no matter what you thought of the performances tonight, the real winners were the people who showed up and took time to watch this. I think we got a lot of good information, he said. In business, search warrant executed at Caterpillar offices. Peoria, Caterpillar Inc.'s tax woes came back to haunt it again Thursday morning with news of a search warrant executed by federal agencies at 3 company offices in Peoria, East Peoria, and Morton. Decatur plant offices were not included in the federal action, which appeared targeted toward long-standing allegations Caterpillar used offshore affiliates to reduce its U.S. tax burden. Congressional hearings dating to 2014 had accused Caterpillar of shortchanging the Internal Revenue Service out of $2.4 billion in taxes. The company vigorously denied the claims. Federal agencies taking part in Thursday's office searches included the IRS's Criminal Investigation Unit, the U.S. Department of Commerce Office of Export Enforcement, and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation's Office of Inspector General. While the warrant was broadly drafted, we believe the execution of this search warrant is regarding, among other things, export filings that relate to the CSARL matter, said Caterpillar spokeswoman Corey Scott in a statement. Caterpillar is cooperating with law enforcement. CSARL is the structured finance arm of Caterpillar that finances equipment purchases and major projects, from coal mines to pipelines, for Caterpillar customers. CSARL has key offices in Switzerland and Australia. In February of 2015, Caterpillar had announced it had received a grand jury subpoena from the U.S. District Court for the Central District of Illinois relating to the movement of cash among U.S. and non-U.S. subsidiaries. The company has been accused by critics of using financial transactions with offshore affiliates to lower its domestic tax bill. Sharon Paul, a Springfield-based spokeswoman for the U.S. Attorney for the Central District of Illinois, confirmed Thursday's searches had taken place but said, "I can't comment on that," when asked what information the federal agencies were hunting. Some employees at Caterpillar's World headquarters in downtown Peoria were told to wait in the building's cafeteria and not to leave without permission while the search took place, according to a report from the Peoria Journal-Star. News of the search warrant comes amid turbulent times for Caterpillar. Former CEO Doug Oberhelman retired January 1st after steering the company through an unprecedented four-year sales slump. The downward plunge has been led by mining-related sales, especially the giant off-road dump trucks and other equipment built at the company's vast Decatur factory. The latest fourth quarter results for Caterpillar Resource Industries segment, which includes the Decatur plant, show it's swung to a quarterly loss of $711 million, a margin that was 700% worse than its fourth quarter 2015 losses. Caterpillar's new CEO, Jim Umpleby, has all this to deal with, plus negotiations with the United Auto Workers Union. Union workers voted by a 93% margin to authorize a strike vote, but have held off taking action while talks continue. Facebook postings by UAW Local 751, which represents Decatur shop floor workers, said the current contract expired midnight, February 28th, but told members to keep showing up for work. "We have agreed to continue working beyond the expiration of the contract in hopes of achieving an agreement in the better interest of all members," the union said in a recent posting. News of the latest law enforcement action deflated Caterpillar's share price, which finished Thursday at $94.36, down $4.20 or 4.26% on the day. Illini embrace their new identity. Raucous home crowd, physical victory rekindle postseason potential. Champaign. That basketball team wearing the orange jerseys Wednesday night, you know, the one that beat Michigan State 73-70 in the best atmosphere in the State Farm Center has seen since they spent $170 million sprucing up the place? Who were those guys? That is definitely not the same Illini basketball team that blew a 10-point lead in the final 3 minutes and lost in this very same building to Winthrop. That was back in November when Illinois defense routinely opened a welcoming path to the basket whenever an opponent needed an easy score. That was not the same team that lost by 32 points on Thanksgiving Day to West Virginia, nor is it the same group that took a 25-point beating in the Big Ten opener at Maryland, nor is it the same team that trailed 15-0 before realizing the game was over before they'd scored a single point at Indiana. It's not even the same team that lost at home to Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Penn State in a period of 12 days less than 3 weeks ago. An amazing and unpredictable transformation has dramatically changed the mindset, the attitude, and surely the confidence level of a team that was on the ropes until four things happened almost simultaneously. Here's what pulled Illinois from the ash pile. 1. The offense was handed to point guard Tajon Lucas. Gross was reluctant to push the freshman from Milwaukee into the starting lineup, but when he did on January 25th, in a victory over Iowa, many things began to change. The ball started moving on offense. There was less standing and dribbling, a nagging issue with other point guards, and Lucas started to cement the team's new tough-minded disposition on defense. Toughness, it turns out, may be Lucas's greatest asset. He's 18 years old, and he's completely unafraid. A key play late in Wednesday's game may have gone unnoticed, with Illinois on top 72-70. Michigan State's Miles Bridges drove hard to the basket in the final seconds, but the ball appeared to pop out of his hands as he pushed a wild shot toward the basket that was rebounded by Illinois Illinois' Kipper Nicholas. After the game, neither Malcolm Hill, Maverick Morgan, or Tracy Abrams knew just how Bridges lost control of the ball, but a review of the tape shows that it was Lucas guarding another player who used a flick of his hand to knock the ball from Bridges' grasp. It was a potential game saver. Number two, Gross shortened the rotation. For a long while, one of Gross's favorite sayings was strength in numbers. He was proud to have a roster he felt gave him multiple options, and early in Big Ten play, he was routinely using a rotation of 10 or 11 players. Illinois got hot once he realized that he had eight truly reliable players, and barring foul trouble, he had enough options within the group. In addition to recent starters, Malcolm Hill, Leron Black, Maverick Morgan, John Lucas, and Tracy Abrams, he trimmed his bench to just Jalen Coleman, Coleman Lands, Michael Fink, and Kipper Nicholas. "That's been very good for us, obviously," Gross said. "Our team has shaped up differently than we thought it would. We had to adapt, tinker, and push buttons, but now we've gotten to the point where we're comfortable. As it turned out, less is more." Number three, addition by subtraction. Gross will never disparage his own players, but the truth is, keeping guard Jaylon Tate and center Mike Thorne Jr. on the bench has made Illinois a better team. They can still be called on if there's foul trouble, and that was the case when Tate played 7 minutes February 18th in a victory at Iowa. But Tate has not played at all in five of the last six games, and the team is better rotating just three guards. Number four, desperation can be a great motivator. It's probably no coincidence that Illinois got rolling once confronted with the realization that its postseason dreams and the coach's future were truly in jeopardy. After losing at home to Penn State on February 11th, the season looked lost. At that point, Illinois was 14-12 and 4-9 in the conference. Anyone talking about the NCAA tournament would have been placed in a straitjacket. Faced with a do-it-now-or-else scenario, Illinois has rattled off four straight victories, two of which are against top 50 teams, Northwestern and Michigan State. A victory Saturday against last-place Rutgers would make it five straight against Big Ten opponents, something an Illini team hasn't done since February 2010. "I can't explain it. I was talking to Tracy about it in practice. It just feels different. Thanks to a number of changes that clicked not a moment too soon, it's a different team instead." On the local page, local briefs for Friday, March 3rd. Bloomington embezzlement case. A Clinton woman accused of stealing more than $400,000 from the medical practice that employed her is in negotiations with federal prosecutors to resolve charges that carry a possible 20-year prison term. In a court filing delaying her March 7th jury trial in U.S. District Court in Springfield, attorneys for the government and Veronica Luster disclosed that the two sides have met on several occasions in an effort to resolve the factual disputes regarding the amounts in issue and recently obtained information. The lawyers have discussed a resolution of this matter, but have not finalized a critical term of any agreement. According to filings by Assistant U.S. Attorney Brian David Freres and defense lawyer L. Lee Smith, a March 17th hearing is set to discuss a change in Luster's not guilty plea she entered shortly after her arrest on mail and wire fraud charges in 2015 related to the alleged embezzlement from Clinton International Medicine and Dr. Farouk Qureshi, Decatur Arts Council murals. A Decatur Area Arts Council is accepting proposals for three new murals planned for this year. Artists can submit several designs. The deadline for submissions is March 31st, 2017. For more information, visit decaturarts.org/murals/. That's decaturarts.org/murals/. Mowequa. Rural Water Award. The Illinois Rural Water Association chose the water sample submitted by the Moquegua Water Department as runner-up for best-tasting water during the 2017 Technical Conference on February 21st in Effingham. Water samples are evaluated by a panel of judges during a blind taste test. Moquegua won first place in 2016, allowing the water superintendent, Louis Jordan, the honor of representing the village during the National Rural Water Association Convention during the Rural Water Rally in Washington, D.C. Decatur. Senior Center Lunch. A St. Patrick's Day party will begin noon Tuesday, March 14th in the Decatur-Macon County Senior Center, 1430 North 22nd Street. The menu will be corned beef and cabbage casserole. Chris Wiley will provide entertainment at 11 a.m. The cost is $5 for members and $6 for non-members. The reservation deadline is noon Monday, March 13th. Call 217-429-1239. That's 429-1239. Shelbyville, watercolor class. Flourish's Gallery in Shelbyville will hold an abstract watercolor class led by local artist Frank Ventura with 2 3-hour classes at 1 p.m. and at 6 p.m. Thursday, March 16th at the Flourish's Gallery and Studio, 140 and a half East Main Street in Shelbyville. Ventura will introduce his recent work using ink with watercolors. Participants will create their own abstract and should bring watercolor paints, brushes, water containers, paper towels, and a black fine-tip ink pen. Paper will be provided. The cost for the class is $15. For reservations, call 217-827-5690. That's 827-5690. Clinton, Electrical Safety. DeWitt County First Responders, Road Commissioners, and Farm Bureau members are invited to dinner and an electrical safety demonstration Thursday, March 16th at the DeWitt County Highway Building, 9900 Revere Road, Clinton. Dinner is scheduled for 5:30 p.m. and the program will begin at 6 p.m. RSVPs are requested by Monday, March 13th. Area fire chiefs can register their departments as a group. The featured speaker is Corn Belt Electricity's Steve Hancock, who will provide a full-scale power line to demonstrate the power of electricity and how that can translate into serious issues if met with large equipment or other obstructions. For more information, email dcfb3@frontier.com. Again, that's dcfb3@frontier.com or call 217-935-2126. That's 935-2126. Updated Argenta Library may reopen next weekend. Argenta. Donna Schall and her staff at the Argenta Oriana Library District are aiming to reopen the newly renovated Argenta Library March 11th. The 5,000-square-foot building has been closed since Thanksgiving while undergoing nearly $64,000 worth of improvements, primarily to even up the floors. This used to be a hardware store, where I'm told they sold groceries out of an addition to the front, Schall said. The floors were a real safety issue. While the building was empty, however, the library district also went ahead and put down new carpet and vinyl flooring, painted the walls, replaced ceiling tiles, and installed brighter LED lighting. The restrooms were also made handicap accessible. The contractor was 4MC Corporation of Argenta. On Wednesday, staff members began shelving the library's collection of 13,000 books, which they had carefully packed away in about 450 boxes donated by Acker's Packaging Solutions of Oriana. "We wanted to do it ourselves so they could be in order," Schall said. Bob and Joanne Nixon stored the books, more than 9 tons, at their farm near Argenta. Cabinet Corner in Argenta loaned the library a van to use with a truck rented from Roberts and Downey Chapel Equipment in Argenta to move some of the furniture to the Oriana Library. Higher traffic items such as DVDs and audiobooks were taken to that location, which expanded its hours during the renovation. The Argenta location will also have expanded hours when it reopens. Funding for the project was provided by three trusts through the Gerber State Bank, Phyllis Madeline Winings Trust, Betts Holmes Trust, and George H. Parr Trust. Jeannie Spears also helped out by reupholstering several chairs and benches. According to Herald and Review archives, in 1978 the former Cotton's Hardware store became the property of former Friends Creek Township Public Library, which merged with the Oriana Village Library in 1990 to form the Argenta Oriana Library District. Shaw said, "We totally reinvented the building, and I think it turned out really well." If you go, it's the Argenta Oriana Library District Library reopening. It's tentatively set for Saturday, March 11th. It's at 100 East Water Street in Argenta. New hours are 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. Tuesday and Thursday, 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Saturday. For more information, visit aopld.org, or call 217-795-2144. That's 795-2144. On the money page, Mike Gulledge named publisher of two Montana newspapers. Mike Gulledge, a former publisher of the Herald and Review and a visible part of the Decatur community, has been named publisher of two newspapers in Montana. He will lead the Missoulian and the Rivali Republic as part of a regional management restructuring. He also serves as publisher for the Billings Gazette in Montana and an operating vice president for Davenport, Iowa, based Lee Enterprises, which owns the properties as well as the Herald and Review. Gulledge, a graduate of Southern Illinois University, joined Lee in 1982 and came to the Herald and Review in 1990 as advertising manager. He later became advertising manager for the Quad City Times, the Lee newspaper in Davenport, but returned to Decatur in 1997 to take on the role of general manager. He was named publisher in 1998. He moved to Montana in 2000, and he told the Herald and Review at the time how the move was bittersweet. "I enjoyed what we've tried to do with the newspaper. I just can't tell you how much I'm going to miss Decatur and the friendships I've made." He and his wife, Susan, live in Billings. Their son, Michael, is a student at Gonzaga University. Mike is an accomplished executive and seasoned publisher. He'll be a great asset to the Missoulian staff in the Missoula community, said Kevin Mowbray, president and CEO of Lee Enterprises. He brings a high level of energy and experience to his new role. "The Missoulian has a deep, rich history of providing excellent contact, and I look forward to building on our successful platform in the region and meeting the future needs of readers and advertisers," Gulledge said. "This is a community that takes a deep interest in its newspaper, and we love covering it." That's all we have time for with the first half of the Decatur Herald and Review, dated March 3rd, 2017. This is Barbara Ridenour. Please stay tuned.